Genesis chapter 39, beginning at verse 11. But one day when he went into the house to do his work, and none of the men of the house was there in the house, she caught him by his garment, saying, "Lie with me." But he left his garment in her hand and fled and got out of the house. And as soon as she saw that he had left his garment in her hand and had fled out of the house, she called to the men of her household and said to them, "See, he has brought among us a Hebrew to laugh at us. He came into me to lie with me, and I cried out with a loud voice. And as soon as he heard that I lifted up my voice and cried out, he left his garment beside me and fled and got out of the house." Then she laid up his garment by her until his master came home. And she told him the same story, saying, "The Hebrew servant whom you have brought among us came into me to laugh at me. But as soon as I lifted up my voice and cried, he left his garment beside me and fled out of the house." As soon as his master heard the words that his wife spoke to him, "This is the way your servant treated me," his anger kindled. And Joseph's master took him and put him into the prison, the place where the king's prisoners were confined, and he was there in prison. But the Lord was with Joseph and showed him steadfast love and gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison. And the keeper of the prison put Joseph in charge of all the prisoners who were in the prison. Whatever was done there, he was the one who did it. The keeper of the prison paid no attention to anything that was in Joseph's charge, because the Lord was with him. And whatever he did, the Lord made it succeed. This is the word of the Lord.
These past two days I spent on a roof, my Nana's roof, with my brother, my dad, and some cousins, re-roofing her roof. Her old roof was leaking. We had some leftover sheet metal, not leftover, just some. We didn't just find some scraps. We got a new roof for my Nana, and we're putting on her, and putting on her roof. And on Friday, it was crazy raining, right? I text my dad Thursday night, "We still doing this tomorrow?" He said, "Yes, just pray for light rain." We did. It did not happen. Just rained and rained and rained. So much so that my brother fell on the roof. He didn't fall off the roof, thank God. But he fell on the roof. And as he fell, he was like, started moaning and groaning and like stayed there for a while. It's like, "Dude, you didn't fall through the roof and you didn't fall off it. You're okay. Be okay." And then he pulled some tin snips and a drill out from his from behind him. Like, "Oh, that's what you fell on. Okay, sorry. That's rough. I apologize for immediately ridiculing you for groaning." That makes sense. But I didn't fall off the roof. We made it. We made this happen. But what I noticed is that we ran out of supplies on Friday night, and my dad had to go Friday morning. So me and my brother, Friday morning, we're back on the roof, we're working with what we got, and we're waiting on our dad to return. But what happened is when all the cousins are around and my dad was missing, we immediately realized that there was a vacuum. Like, there was a leadership vacuum. We're like, "Where's my dad at? He's the one that tells us what to do. He's not here." So what did everyone do? They all looked to my brother. And I was like, "Thank God, because I have no clue what we're doing. I'm just up there. Just tell me what to do, and I can drill screws into wood. That works." But they all looked to him, and they looked to my brother. My brother stepped up, and he made it happen. And that's what happens. And I realized that when I was sitting there, I was like, "That's pretty interesting. That in the absence of my father, we all look to my dad, and that's what happens. In the absence of leadership, or in the absence of someone's presence, we look to something else. We look to someone else." What happens this morning in Genesis 39 is what we've heard multiple times throughout Genesis, is that there's not an absence of God, but God is present with his people. And I don't mind, I unashamedly will tell you this again, because this is the text's desire again and again and again. This is God's desire, is to press into your heart, to press into your mind, to press into your life that God is with you. We've said it, I feel like, 80 times throughout this book, and we'll say it again because the book says again, because God says it again, that God is with you. God will not leave you. God will not forsake you. So that's where we begin. Not missing someone's absence, so we look to someone else, but knowing that our good, good Father has not left us. In verse 1 of chapter 39, we'll work through the chapter. Now Joseph had been brought down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, captain of the guard, an Egyptian, had bought him from the Ishmaelites who had brought him down there. The Lord was with Joseph, and he became a successful man. And he was in the house of his Egyptian master. His master saw that the Lord was with him and that the Lord caused all that he did to succeed in his hands. So Joseph found favor in his sight and attended him, and he made him overseer of his house and put him in charge of all that he had. From the time that he made him overseer in his house and over all that he had, the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house for Joseph's sake. The blessing of the Lord was on all that he had in house and field. So he left all that he had in Joseph's charge, and because of him, he had no concern about anything but the food he ate. So we're back to Joseph. Two Sundays ago, we began with Joseph in chapter 37 of Genesis. The rest of Genesis hones in on Joseph, but I do want you to consider Judah. So it may have felt like a little bit of an interruption last week when we start with Joseph, we think we're going with Joseph, and then last chapter was all about Judah. But I want you to consider Judah in this story because Joseph is the more prominent character in the rest of the book of Genesis, but I believe it's a tale of two brothers. It's a tale of these two brothers. It's Joseph and Judah. Previously, we've seen Judah in relationship with his brother. What did he do? He led his other brothers to sell Joseph into slavery. He led his other brothers to convince their dad that Joseph was dead. And then he leaves. He leaves his family, goes down into Canaan on his own volition. He's not made a slave and taken there. He goes on his own volition, marries a Canaanite woman. And then it transpired last week that we saw he withheld his son from this woman, Tamar. And then, from there, she tricks him, acts like a prostitute, dresses up like a prostitute, and he has sex with a prostitute. He gets revealed, he gets found out, and he confesses his sin, that he withheld his son from Tamar. And I think that's a pivotal point in the story of Judah, because from here until the rest of the chapter, you'll see that this man who has sold his brother into slavery, who has deceived his dad, who's done some wicked things, begins to change. God changes him through the rest of the story. That God is bigger than Judah's sin. And God is going to change and transform Judah. And it's going to be a completely different person by the time we're done with this story. It's going to blow your mind. But today we're back to Joseph. Joseph, he's transported as a slave to Egypt, sold as a slave to Potiphar. Potiphar is the Egyptian who is an officer of Pharaoh. He's a captain of the guard, a well-to-do dude who's got some authority, some chops on him. Joseph, though, is his slave. It's very specific, though, the text is when it says that he's in the house. And so he's not in the field as a slave. He's a house slave. And then the text goes on to say that Joseph is a successful house slave, so successful that he's made the slave in charge of the house. And then his success continues, so much so that Potiphar makes him second in charge over everything that Potiphar owns. So it's Potiphar and then Joseph. Joseph takes care of, is in charge of everything that is Potiphar's. But why? Why is Joseph so successful? The text says, because the Lord was with Joseph. And the Lord made everything Joseph touched gold. Like, that's just what happens. Everything Joseph touches, it's gold. Like, it just, success, it just exudes money. Whatever he does, it gets wealthier, it gets better. There's more crops, there's more money, there's more people. There's just more and more and more. The Lord is with Joseph. He blesses Joseph, and he blesses Potiphar through Joseph. Our minds here should begin to go back to the beginning of Genesis when God promises to Abraham that I'm going to bless you, and I'm going to bless your family so that your family would be a blessing to all the families of the earth. And this is what's happening here. It's a single man. It's just Joseph. But he's in not his own land. He's a slave in a foreign land in Egypt. And he is blessed by God. And he's going to be a blessing to Potiphar. A blessing to Potiphar's house. And so Potiphar's house is just being blessed. Like, the text is very clear that the Lord being with Joseph is inextricably linked to God blessing Joseph materially. and blessing Potiphar materially. Like, Potiphar is banking on this situation. Like, he's just making dollar after dollar. Fist over fist of cash is what's happening with Potiphar. Potiphar is able to buy that fresh new chariot with the wood grain wheels, right? And that candy paint. Like, that's what Potiphar is getting right now. Potiphar doesn't have a radio, right? It's Egypt. It's, thousands of years ago. But what does he have? He just hires a guy because he's got so much to sing to him as he commutes to the city. This is how much money Potiphar has. Like, he just, hey, man, sing. I need some music. Hello from the other side. Like, the guy just has to sing whenever he tells him. No, I don't like that song. Next station. Bop. No, not that one. No, I don't like that song. It's horrible. It's a horrible song. Next station. That's what happens. Potiphar's just making bank off of this situation. Do you know what this means? Up to this point, do you know what this means? It means that God is working his purpose. That's what God is doing. God is working his purpose. You know what it doesn't mean? This doesn't mean that you will have a fresh new chariot, that you will make money fist over fist because God is with you. That's not what this means. God's blessing you, God being with you, does not equate to the American dream. It doesn't. It doesn't mean that you'll be healthy and wealthy. It doesn't mean you'll have the money. It doesn't mean you'll have the cars. It doesn't mean you'll have a beautiful home. It doesn't mean you have a boat that you'll get to eat out whenever and wherever you want. This is not what this means. God being with you, God blessing you, does not equate to the American dream. God has not promised this to you. He's not. And I know you've heard many stuff over the years that's the exact contradiction to this, the opposite of this. Like, you've heard those things, right? Where you'll have more money, you'll have a better life, you'll be rid of that sickness, you'll have more friends, if you have more faith, if you give more money, if you believe harder. Like, that's what it comes down to. That's not what God has promised you. It's not. What he has promised you, what he has promised us, is that he will be with us. That's what he's promised. The opposition in our hearts is not only what people have told us, but it's oftentimes that we want those things more than we want God being with us. We want that American dream. We want our illness to be taken away immediately. We want to be rid of our suffering immediately because God is with us. But that's not how it works. That is not what God promises you. He promises that he is present with you. The big idea this morning is this. God is with you in your prosperity. God is with you in your adversity. And God is with you in your temptation. The presence of prosperity doesn't mean he's with you. Him telling you he's with you is what means he's with you. The presence of adversity and suffering and temptation doesn't mean that he's absent. Those are not signs that you can point to and say, God's absent because I'm suffering this way. God's absent because I'm not making money. God's absent because I am sick. You can't point at those things and say that those are signs to explain if God is with you or not with you. The sign that you can point to and say declaratively, like confidently, boldly, that God is with us is the cross of Christ. That's the sign you can point at. That is the sign that you can point at and say, his perfect love towards me. The Old Testament, it does this. In this text and in the whole Old Testament, it really presents material wealth with the blessings of God. That's what it does. Like, if you live faithfully and you follow God, you're going to be blessed material. That's how the Old Testament presents life. That's where many of you get in trouble is, like, you read the Proverbs and you see, like, if I work hard, I get money. If I work hard, I get, like, vats of grain. Number one, you can't apply it that way, right? Like, how many guys got vats? Yeah, anybody got a vat? You don't need grain, right? You don't need vats of grain. That's not what you already have to interpret a little bit and say, oh, that means just wealth. And then say, okay, if I work hard, I get wealth. But you can't interpret what is normative as a universal truth. that this may be the typical way that the world works, but this is not God's promise to you. I've known too many godly Christians that have worked hard, toiled hard, labored hard, didn't have vats of grain, barely made it by. The New Testament presents it as this material wealth will not be now, but it will be a future blessing. That's when Jesus says, store up for yourselves treasures in heaven, right? I'm going to bless you, and what are you going to? That's going to be material. Like that, what's going to look like is when you see Jesus face to face, when you see him fully. Just if I would make it maybe simplistic, but if you think about the Old Testament blessings of God, it's typically connected to material wealth. And if you think about the New Testament blessings of God, it's typically connected to spiritual blessing. That's when Paul just busts on the scenes and he says, this is who you are for three chapters in Ephesians. This is who you are. This is how you've been blessed. This is how you've been blessed. And what is it? You've been forgiven. You've been made clean. You've been made sons and daughters. You've been chosen for the foundation of the world. This is who you are. This is what I've done for you. I've lavished my love for you. I've lavished my affection for you. I've made you righteous. I've made you mine. That's his promise. That's the blessing of the New Testament. The New Testament actually warns us that following Jesus, living a faithful life, may actually equate to losing money, losing health, losing these things, suffering, tribulation, persecution, even death. So my first warning is not to take this text and run with it and turn it into some skewed health and wealth theology. You can't do that with this text. You can't do justice to the text and do that. You can't make it think that God's presence equates to material blessing to you now. Even from this text, consider it. Even in this text where God is blessing Joseph material, blessing Potiphar material, you know what's true for Joseph even in this moment? He's a slave. How can you say that God being with you means health and wealth when, in this moment, Joseph is a slave? He's treated like property. Someone bought him. Someone said, I think this person is worth this amount of money. And the other person said, yeah, this object is worth this amount of money. I'll take it from you. And I'll own it, and it's mine, and I'll tell it what to do, and I'll make it do what I want to do. It's at my disposal. That's a whole family view of Joseph in this text. That's a whole cultural view in this time. That Joseph is just a piece of property and he is dispensable. The blessing of God to Joseph is ultimately this: the Lord is with him in prosperity and adversity. The Lord is with him. The Lord is with him. And Joseph's adversity continues. Like, it doesn't stop. It doesn't get better immediately. Let's look at the end of the chapter, and then we'll come back to the middle. Verse 19, and as soon as his master heard the words that his wife spoke to him, this is the way your servant treated me. His anger was kindled, and Joseph's master took him and put him into prison, the place where the king's prisoners were confined, and he was there in prison, but the Lord was with Joseph and showed him steadfast love and gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison. And the keeper of the prison put Joseph in charge of all the prisoners who were in the prison. Whatever was done there, he was the one who did it. The keeper of the prison paid no attention to anything that was in Joseph's charge because the Lord was with him. And whatever Joseph did, the Lord made it succeed. So Joseph is thrown into prison falsely. We'll get back to it. But he's thrown into prison. And again, we read, the Lord was with Joseph. His suffering intensified. And we're reminded, the Lord is with Joseph. The Lord is still with Joseph. And he again blesses Joseph, makes him successful, gives him favor in the sight of the warden. So much so that the warden of the prison puts him in charge again. So this is what's happened. Joseph has been put in charge of this family unit, right? Second in charge of this whole family in Potiphar. He gets thrown into prison, and then he's in prison. He gets put second in charge of this entire organization, of this entire prison. And it's just foreshadowing what's going to happen with Joseph. Right when with Joseph, everything that he touches is gold. Everywhere that he goes, he becomes the second in charge. It's just that's where he's headed. It's a family. It's a prison. It's going to be the entire kingdom. It's going to be the entire nation. But for now, he's just second in charge of the prison, still a slave, and now a prisoner, which begs the question, wouldn't God blessing Joseph mean that he's no longer a slave? Like, that's where my mind goes. Wouldn't God being with him, blessing him, mean that no longer a slave and no longer a prisoner? Why is he someone's property and why is he locked away? Like, I never thought when I grow up, I want to be the head slave in charge. I want to be treated like a piece of property. No, I'd rather be the head prisoner in charge, but still locked away. But this is how we think about things. We often think, maybe Christians, we think that God being with us means the absence of suffering, means the absence of these bad things. But then non-Christians and some of you that don't know Jesus, you think about this. You think the good that I've done outweighs the bad. So bad things shouldn't happen to good people, and I'm a good person. And so you put your hope, you put your life into the hands of how you've done recently, how you've handled yourself, what are the good things, and hopefully those good things have outweighed your bad, and so good things happen to good people, and that's what you have put your life in. But the invitation of the text is this, is that there's, number one, bad things happen to good people all the time. Number two, there's actually no good people. This is the story of Genesis. There's no good people. There's only a good father. You can't put your hope, your life, your trust in if you're doing good or doing bad or how that weighs. Or you can't even define who God is based upon your current situation. Is God really good? Well, yes, because I've got a lot of money. Things are taken care of. I've got a lot of friends. I'm good. Well, God's not with me now. Why? I lost those friends and I lost that money. The Lord is with Joseph in prosperity and adversity. This is true for you, fam. The Lord is with you in prosperity and adversity. Your suffering does not mean that he has left you or stopped loving you. He is with you not because you are faithful or because you make good, wise decisions like Joseph. He is with you because there's another man who is falsely accused. There's another man who is treated like a prisoner, who was beaten and eventually murdered. One who was cursed by men and blessed by God. One who was put second in charge of galaxies. One who rules perfectly and wisely and lovingly. One who sent the Holy Spirit to be present with us when he ascended to the right hand of the Father. One who said, I will never leave you nor forsake you. The Lord is with you. Not because how you're doing or what you've done, but because Jesus has come to you, because Jesus has suffered for you, because he has made you his. Nothing can separate us from the love of God. I love that. That's Paul's question, Romans 8. What can? Typically when Paul asks questions, his answer is a resounding no. Like, he's like, let me raise your thoughts, make you think maybe there's an option. What do you guys think? Is there anything that can separate you from the love of God? Anything. Like yourself, what you do, your choices, the enemy, your sin. Can anything separate you? Think about it. What are the options? No. No, Paul says. Nothing can separate you from the love of God. He's with you in prosperity and adversity. I want you to think about those two options because oftentimes you probably don't feel like you've been abandoned by God in your prosperity. What tends to happen in your prosperity is that you begin to abandon God. You begin to forget about God. You begin to not consider God. You think, I've got this, I'm taken care of, I'm making it happen. And you begin to think, God, But even in you abandoning God, you not considering God, that does not mean God has left you. God is still with you. Even when you abandon, God will not abandon. Or some of you do feel abandoned in your suffering. Maybe you've lost something greatly. Maybe you had a friend that died recently, or you've been falsely accused. Someone has treated you like a dog. Maybe you got passed on that promotion that you thought was yours. Maybe you lost that relationship that you thought was heading towards marriage. Even when you feel abandoned by God, He is still with you. Your adversity, your trials are not a sign that He's missing. He does not abandon you in your adversity. The text goes on. Not only is He with you in prosperity, in your adversity, He's also with you in your temptation. When you are being tempted to sin, when you're being pulled to sin, when sin is ever before you, when it's put in your face, when you're tempted to run to it, God does not leave you to yourself. In verse 7, or the end of verse 6. Now Joseph was handsome in form and appearance. And after a time, his master's wife cast her eyes on Joseph and said, "Lie with me." But he refused and said to his master's wife, "Behold, because of me, my master has no concern about anything in the house, and he has put everything that he has in my charge. He's not greater in this house than I am, nor has he kept back anything from me except you, because you are his wife. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God?" And as she spoke to Joseph day after day, he would not listen to her, to lie beside her, or to be with her. But one day, when he went into the house to do his work and none of the men of the house were there in the house, she caught him by his garment, saying, "Lie with me." But he left his garment in her hand and fled and got out of the house. And as soon as she saw that he had left his garment in her hand and had fled out of the house, she called to the men of her household and said to them, "See, he has brought us among us a Hebrew to laugh at us. He came in to lie with me, and I cried out with a loud voice. And as soon as he heard that I lifted my voice and cried out, he left his garment beside me and fled and got out of the house." Then she laid up his garment by her until his master came home. And she told him, Potiphar, the same story, saying, "The Hebrew servant whom you have brought among us came into me to laugh at me, but as soon as I lifted up my voice and cried, he left his garment beside me and fled out of the house." First, recall that in Potiphar's sight, Joseph has found favor, right? Potiphar is grateful for Joseph. He enjoys Joseph. He appreciates Joseph. He recognizes that the Lord is with Joseph. That's why he's being blessed in the way that he's blessed. That's why he's able to buy that fresh chariot. But in Potiphar's wife's eyes, Joseph has found lust. Favor in the husband, now lust in the wife, and now she lusts after Joseph. She wants to have sex with him. The two Hebrew words that are translated to "lie with me" are really just a coarse proposition. It's a brutish, coarse proposition that this wife makes to Joseph. "Lie with me." And then notice again, please, that Joseph is a slave and he's being treated like an item. She wants to use him. And in that, there should be a stark contrast as you consider even the words that are translated, that the Lord was with Joseph, and she says, "Lie with me." She doesn't love Joseph. She wants to use Joseph. God loves Joseph. She lusts Joseph. Sexual idolatry always dehumanizes the object of its lust. When you worship something that God has created, something God created good, when you worship sex, God created it, it's good, but when you worship it, and you got to use people for that, that means you dehumanize the person to an object. You make them an object. And this is what she does. And this is a pertinent question just for our culture. What's happened for millennia is still happening. The question is Joseph a human or an item? Is Joseph a tool or a friend? This is an attack, a blatant attack on the image of God that we saw at the beginning of Jesus, that men and women are created with value and dignity and worth because they are created in the image of God. So this shouldn't be even a question. I shouldn't even have to talk about this, but because sin has broken the world in Genesis 3, and we thought we were the leader, that we could figure it out, we could do what was right in our own eyes, and we fractured this world. Now there's sin and suffering abounding. Now we have to talk about this question of, is this person a person or are they an item? And not even how you would answer the question, how you functionally treat those people. Are they a person or are they an item? Sexual idolatry always dehumanizes the object of its lust. So let's make it more with us. Are they a person or an item? The question is this, are babies in utero people, or are they the woman's property? Are people on your TV, on your computer, image bearers of God, or are they objects for you to pleasure yourself? Do they have dignity, value, and worth, or are they items at your disposal? Maybe it's more subtle than that. Are your grandparents, are your children cherished members of your family? Are they items that you have to deal with? Are they problems that you have to deal with? Throughout Genesis, there's been an attack on the personhood, the attack on the image of God, that we've been made in the image of God. And the question comes down oftentimes to this: are they people or are they items? Do we treat them as people? Do we treat them as objects? Do we dehumanize them? Like, are your coworkers men and women created by God, or are they frustrations you have to deal with? Are they the sum of the frustrating things they say to you, or are they created with dignity, value, and worth because they've been created by a creator? Joseph being made a slave and hit on by Potiphar's wife should incite within us anger that we are against this, that he's not property, he's a man. He's not a sex object, he's a human. He's a reflection of the one who created him. He has a soul, he has emotions and thoughts and hopes and fears and dreams. Don't discard him, don't use him. But this is the sin in our hearts, that we take things that God has created and we worship them. We make them the ultimate thing. We worship them over God. And either they fell us or we use them as objects. The text calls it this: she does what is right in her own eyes. That's a scary phrase throughout the Bible. That's the repeated refrain in the book of Judges. They did what was right in their own eyes. They did what was right in their own eyes. They did what was right in their own. They dehumanized people. They used them as objects. They did evil again and again and again. She does what is right in her own eyes. She's given over to her desire. Where Joseph is a slave to Potiphar, she's a slave to lust. What's amazing in light of this is Joseph's beautiful response. His response to this ongoing and escalating seduction and being treated as an item. What does Joseph do? He refuses. Where last week, Judah just gets propositioned by a prostitute on a road, and he just says yes. Joseph is repeatedly seduced and cried out to him and said, come, lie with me, lie with me, lie with me, lie with me, let's do this, let's do this, let's do this. And he refuses. He doesn't give her an ear, he flees. Like, this is a good example of fighting temptation. Some of you guys just, it's like a game for you. Like, you play with sin. Joseph fights it. Joseph knows that this is a war, that this is a battle. So just he doesn't play around. He doesn't toy with it. Later on in the text, whenever it says that to lie with her, to be with her, like she started off with lie with me. And then she kind of comes back around and says, please just be with me. Like just lay next to me. Like she tries to make it a subtle thing so that it will turn into, right? All right, let's start smaller then. Let's do this little thing. Then hopefully it'll turn into. And some of you guys toy with that. You play around with that. Like, okay, I won't go to the full extent, but I'll just play a little bit with this temptation. I'll just play with it. Joseph refuses. And he refuses, initially appealing to my master and my God. He refuses because he knows that you don't take what's not been given to you. Right? That's a dad statement through and through for me. That's what I tell my son. Like, you don't take what's not been given to you. Right? My wife tells him, hey, buddy, grab your hands. You know, like he's on the table and he's just like grabbing stuff. She's like, hey, let's put your grabby hands away. And then it's turned into, I'll hold him. And he says, get your grabby hands off me. I'm like, whoa, where did that come from? Your kids like twist things on you. Like we're trying to teach you and grow you. And now now I'm loving you. And like, get my grabby hands off you. Like, I love you, man. Don't push me away. I'm with you. But this is what happens. Joseph refuses because he knows that you don't take what's not yours. You don't grab what's not been given to you. But then she continues, day in, day out, again and again and again, whispering to him, seducing him. But Joseph does not give her an ear. So some of you guys are like Joseph. You refused initially. But that day in just dripping, that nagging temptation repeatedly at you gets you. Like you begin, I got my resolve right now. Like I don't want to run to this. I don't want to get into this. I don't want to be back in this sin. But your resolve fades and you begin to listen. And you're like, yes, that does sound good. This would be good for me. This would make me feel better. This would be a quick escape that would help me get rid of whatever is problematic in my life or my suffering with me that I could run to this thing. But Joseph does not give her an ear. He doesn't listen to her seduction. He doesn't consider her propositions. He remains resolved not to do this great sin against God. And then when it escalates, when it goes from verbal to physical, he flees. Like when it gets real, Joseph just runs, right? Just runs. Some of you guys are still toying with it, still playing with it. Then it gets real, and you're like, I can stick through this. Hear from Joseph, hear from the New Testament, flee sexual immorality. Like, just run. You got to run. You got to run from this. God calls you more to, I see that, I want that, I get that. There's some base desires. That's our cultural desires. If you see it, you want it, get it. Just do it, whatever you want. And who am I to speak into your life and say that you shouldn't go after that? If it's good for you, if it works for you, then that's good, man. That would be cool for you. It's good for you. It's not good for me, but I can't really speak into it. So if you want it, do it. Get it. The master has given everything to Joseph except his wife. This should, again, recall the beginning of Genesis, right? When a good father gives Adam and Eve this entire garden except for one tree. Unlike Joseph, Adam and Eve eat from that one thing that was forbidden, that wasn't given to them. Joseph does not. He refuses. He says, how could I do such a great sin against God? He like David, sees that his sin is ultimately against God. She only considers what's right in her own eyes. Joseph considers what's right in God's eyes. And that Joseph's real master is not Potiphar. It's God. Some of you guys need to hear that the different aspects of the Lord being with you for your prosperity. When you hear that the Lord is with you, you should be reminded that he has not left you. Even when you've abandoned him in your mind, when you've ran from him, you run after the gods, he's not abandoned you, and then that he's with you, and that he calls you, not for love of money, that you would love him. And then others of you in the suffering and the adversity, the Lord being with you should be a warm blanket for your soul. It should be a refreshing drink on a hot day, that it would comfort you in your suffering. And then others for you in this temptation, you should hear that you are not the master. You don't do what's right in your own eyes, but the Lord is your master. That's what you need to hear when you hear the Lord is with you. Like many authors of the New Testament, Joseph has the same thing. I'm a slave to God. James, a slave to Jesus Christ. Paul, a slave to Jesus Christ. I'm not my own master. I have a master. I don't do what's just right in my own eyes. I don't make those calls. I do what's right in my master's eyes. You know what helps you to fight temptation? Knowing that you have a master. You don't do whatever you want. You have a master. A good and gracious master, yes, but a master. You're not lord of your domain. You're not king of your castle. You're a slave to Jesus. It's easy to say yes to sin when you say no to Jesus' authority. I'll tell you that again. It's easy to say yes to sin when you say no to Jesus' authority. I don't need a master. I have my own master. One of the things I tell my son is that when he's not listening to me and he's doing his own thing, I tell him, Jude, come here, let's talk. Hey, buddy, I'm your daddy. And you're acting like you're the daddy. And when you act like you're the daddy, it means that you don't have a daddy and you need a daddy. And I'm your daddy. I'm your daddy, right? You're my son? Yes. And what? And he says, you're my daddy. And this is what you need to be reminded of. When you do what's right in your own eyes, you act as if you're the master. But the true and gracious master grabs you in his arms and says, when you act like this, you act like you're the master, but you need a master. You understand how unruly your heart is, right? You understand how crazy your desires become. You need a master, and I'm your master. It's easy to say yes to sin when you say no to Jesus' authority. It's easy to run to pornography and masturbation and sex before marriage and sex outside of marriage and adultery when you refuse Jesus' rule and reign. Easy to sin when you refuse Jesus' authority. You know what? It's easier to refuse sin when you submit to Jesus' authority. I have a master, and he's a good and gracious master. This is how Jesus refused Satan's temptation, right? Jesus didn't have Satan come to me like, oh man, I think I can figure out. I can just kind of toy with this. Let me play intellectual games with this. Let me just see what Satan's saying. Let me try to take it to its logical conclusion. No, Jesus fights the temptation, submitting himself to God's word and God's will. Like Satan has some very seductive offers to Jesus. If you've read this passage recently, it's amazing. The offers that Satan makes to Jesus is to have the glory without the suffering, to rule over everything, but you won't have to go the path of the cross. The offers of health and wealth and success. But Jesus appeals to God's word. God has said, this is God's will. So he refuses Satan's offers and he goes the path that's set before him. The path that's set before him, Jesus, is not health and wealth theology. It's suffering and humiliation. He's going to be falsely accused. He's going to be ridiculed. He's going to be beaten. He's going to be murdered. But then exalted. Just that Joseph eventually comes out of the prison, Jesus comes out of the tomb. Sent to the right hand of the Father. And just as Joseph was put in charge of the entire family, the entire prison, you know what? Jesus is put in charge over the galaxies, ruling and reigning currently. The Lord is with you in your adversity, in your prosperity, and in your temptation. I wrestled with this week. And if you know me, one of my go-tos is the Psalms. And as I wrestled through, the Lord being with me through adversity. Oh, he's such a good comfort. And then in my prosperity, that he has not abandoned me, and that I would love him more than I would love that prosperity. The gifts that he would give, I would worship the giver, not the gifts. And then in my temptation, I would know that the Lord is with me and he's holy. And he calls me to be holy as he is holy, and to aggressively put sin to death. Not toy with it, not play with it, but put it to death. I wrote this off of Psalm 23, just kind of the opposite. But I felt like this was my prayer. This is where my heart was. I don't need a shepherd. I'm fine. I'll find my own rest and comfort. I'll provide my own peace of mind. I'll make my heart joyful. I'll do what's right in my own eyes. I hope you hear the arrogance there. But then this is what this really means. When I walk through the valley of deep darkness, I will fear evil, for I am alone. I'm exposed and am vulnerable to attack and death. I am anxious. And then I wrote one phrase and then circled it vehemently. I need a shepherd. I need a shepherd. I don't need the prosperity. I don't need whatever that enticing, seductive thing that sin calls me to. I don't need it. And when I'm in suffering, I really don't need that quick escape thing that kind of makes me feel better in that moment, but immediately makes me feel worse. What I need day in and day out is one who's there day in and day out, and that's the Lord. The Lord is with us in our prosperity, in our adversity, and our temptation.